From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. There are few things in nature more complicated and more fascinating than the human brain. And no one does a better job of cataloging the brain's oddities than Oliver Sacks. He'll stop by later to tell us some stories about the brain and music, as today we explore some singular brains. One brain condition science has only recently put a name to is Asperger's syndrome. John Elder Robison has it.
I was really, really smart about imagining electronic circuits and imagining how musical signals flowed through them. And I was really, really dumb as a rock when it came to things like social connections and what to do with other people.
John Elder is currently on his fourth successful career, which he'll tell us about in a few minutes. Nikki Gottlieb is a much younger man, also with Asperger's. He still lives at home.
I'm hoping that there is a kind of support system so that I can still lead this empty life that I'm so loving, but still, when the time is right, then I can do the normal life and move out. I'm very happy right now not working, but I do have to say that if I had to have a job, I still would like to have a penthouse office, and I do want to be pretty much Donald Trump or Bill Gates.
Physically, I'm a man, but mentally and emotionally, I'm a boy. I'm still a child.
Right from the start,
he was nursing so oddly. He couldn't bond.
I remember when I saw him when he was first born, I said, this is a child who will suffer us gladly, but his mind is on higher things. He was like a philosopher king.
I was surprised that I couldn't connect with him. I mean, I could connect with him, but I couldn't catch his eyes.
He was clearly, something was not right. As the top neurologist in New York, child neurologist, said to us quite cheerfully, well, we really don't know much, but about 15% of the cases we do know about emerge completely unscathed, and the rest can range from minor learning disabilities to total vegetable retardation.
The doctor calls. He says, Mrs. Gottlieb, it's the worst. It's very bad.
Everybody rallied. Needless to say, your mother was great. I behaved relatively well. You were sad but wonderful. So that's when I decided you were a good person and I didn't have to worry about you.
Excerpts from the opening few minutes of Today's Man, a film by Lizzie Gottlieb, which was recently shown in the Independent Lens series on PBS. Lizzie and Nikki, her brother with Asperger's, are the children of Robert Gottlieb, a dance critic and former editor-in-chief of The New Yorker magazine, and actress Maria Tucci. The Gottlieb family's worried about what will happen to Nikki once his parents can no longer care for him. So Lizzie, who's been documenting her baby brother's life for years, decided to chronicle his efforts to find a job and move out of his parents' house. Steve Paulson watched Today's Man and then spoke with Lizzie and Nikki Gottlieb.
There's a scene in the documentary about your first job at Chase, and you were very excited about it, but it didn't go well from the very beginning. Can you tell me what happened?
I arrived at this job, and, you know, I always had this fantasy of Park Avenue. And it also had the added bonus because it was on my street, 48th Street. It could not be more convenient. Anyway, all that I was so excited about. And as I clearly state in the movie, you know, in that scene in the garden, if you remember, is I was shocked to find it surrounded by blacks and Hispanics. And I said to the job coach, I feel like I'm working in Harlem and not on Park Avenue. And there was also, if you remember, about the 48th Street scene, you know, I asked if I could go home. Anyway, all that piled up.
And, well, and the other piece of that is apparently when you made this comment about it feels like you're working in Harlem, that was
that
was overheard by some of the, the blacks and Hispanics working in that office. It was not just
or
her.
Or my supervisor, which is what counts. And she was also black.
So that from the very start, that puts you one down.
The second day of the job. Yep.
So the second day of the job, you were basically fired.
Yep.
So, Lizzie, when you heard about this, what was your reaction?
Well, I mean, we were so horrified, my family, and really mortified, as you can imagine. It was really awful. That's not the kind of thing I would expect Nikki or anyone to think, let alone feel. So it was, you know, shocking and also incredibly disappointing because this is a job that he had been waiting for 6 months, waiting to go to with great anticipation. And it was, you know, the first real job of his life. And we were hoping that this was like the thing that would kind of launch him from childhood into adulthood was having a job. So on many, many levels, it was really upsetting. I think as we understand it, and as Nikki and I have talked about it, I think it came down to, you know, Nikki watches a lot of television, a lot of soap operas, and he has notions about what's glamorous in the world. And they're pretty much, I think, directly based on television. And I think what he saw there did not match his notion of a glamorous office setting. Is that right, Nikki?
It is right.
But
absolutely.
That doesn't excuse that kind of a comment.
And the other piece of that is even if someone might be feeling that way, thinking that, normal behavior is you don't say that out loud.
Of course, you don't. It's offensive to say any kind of personal remark like that, no matter how you feel.
And I, you know, I have to say I hesitated in putting it into the movie because it seemed so horrible and really decided that we needed to show all the, you know, less attractive parts as well as the more attractive parts of Nikki and, you know, of the kinds of socially inappropriate things that I think people with Asperger can do or say.
Well, Nikki, did you learn from that experience, or is that just something that's going to happen again and again, that you may say certain things that other people would find offensive?
Well, I did learn that, but I think more importantly, with that particular experience, I learned the truth about what Park Avenue really was. That it wasn't the image that I knew. It wasn't Richard Gere in Pretty Woman or Pat Sajak or anyone else I admired who dressed that way and fit the Park Avenue. Or it wasn't only that.
Now, there's another piece of this film that's been made about you, about the difficulties of moving out of your parents' house. I mean, you've basically lived in your parents' house your whole life. You talk about the perks that you have there, but the normal trajectory of most people is when they reach a certain age, let's say 20 years old, they move out. They strike out on their own. Why has this been so hard for you, Nikki?
I don't have a lot of tools for living alone, but I will say that even though I do lack the skills, you know, because of the perks, I think it's really my own free will. And I certainly think that I actually do feel that if I was thrust into an apartment, I would do just fine or I'd be just average. But I just really, for the pleasure, for those perks, that is really why I do not want to move out.
And it's worth pointing out, at least the picture that I get from the film is that your parents are wonderful people. I mean, they've just been incredibly kind and nurturing towards you. I mean, I can understand why you'd want to stay there.
Well, it's not even my
Can I answer that
sure.
for a moment? Also, I just want to say that, you know, Nikki started to say that he lacks a lot of the tools for living on his own. And I think that this is a really serious situation in our country, in these communities. There are very, very few resources for adults with Asperger syndrome. Asperger syndrome was only identified in this country in 1994, so it's a relatively new diagnosis. And there are more and more stuff available for children with Asperger syndrome, but really nothing for adults. And I've found that a lot of adults with Asperger syndrome are living with aging parents, relatives. They're not, in general, I would say, they're not quite fully capable of living independently, but they're too high-functioning and intelligent and, you know, too live on their own. And it's a very serious and upsetting situation. And I think that one thing that I would like to do, and I've been talking to people about doing since the film came out, is to try to create housing situations where, you know, a group of people with Asperger's syndrome could live independently but with some kind of supervision.
What gets in the way of living on your own?
I mean, I think it's on a practical level, it's things like you might leave the stove on, you might leave the door wide open. You know, we live in my family lives in Manhattan, and my parents went away for a weekend once, and Nikki stayed at home, and he left the front door.
That was 10 years ago.
Okay. Well, 10 years ago, he left the front door to their house open for a full day onto the street, and no one came in, thank God. But, you know, that's not the kind of thing that you can generally do.
That was 10 years ago, before the film was even started.
That's true. But I'm giving an example of the kind of things that could be
But I do still have things like that.
Have you had experiences of living on your own for certain periods of time?
Yes. I did have that apartment that's in the movie only for 3 days. And
you want to tell them what happened with the apartment? Nikki moved out into an apartment on his own.
Just the one that you saw in the movie. And I will say also, before I get into the details of that apartment, that after graduating from high school, I did go to this place called College Living Experience in Florida, where I was for 7.5 months. But other than that...
But it didn't work out, and it was not a good experience.
It did not work out for other reasons, maybe partly that. But again, that was 10 years ago.
But the apartment in New York...
That and the apartment in New York was my only living alone that I've ever had.
Can you talk about what happened?
All right, now I will tell you what happened. All right. First of all, I was locked in once when I was trying to go to work.
You locked yourself in?
No, I couldn't open the door. I was locked in, and I needed somebody to come over. Second, the floor creaked, and I'm a pacer. And you saw how small that room is. That's the whole apartment. And I do pace a lot, and that, of course, posed a huge problem.
Because it bothered the neighbors.
And the third thing was that I could not operate the radiator. And the heat was high. And even at the end of February, with the window open, it was too hot.
But also, I think the neighbors thought Nikki was too noisy.
The neighbors did, but I'm telling you, and that's the other element.
What you're saying is that little things that most people could adjust to drive you crazy.
Well, no, I think, well, yes, but those three things have to do with this particular apartment itself.
Well, this is a really important issue, it would seem to me, for what's going to happen in the future. Your parents are getting older, and I suppose there will be a real question at some point. They will not be able to look after you the way they have all these years. It does raise the question of how important it is for you to be able to function on your own, or at least outside of your parents' home.
Well,
I think this is, I mean, in a way, if I can answer that, that's part of the reason that I made the film, because we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I think Nikki and I will have to work that out together. I'm 7 years older, 7.5 years older than Nikki.
And you're Nikki's only sibling, right?
I'm Nikki's only sibling. And I have my own children and husband. And, you know, I think Nikki and I and my parents would all like it if we could get Nikki set up in some kind of a job and his own place to live in the near future. But it's very complicated. It's really complicated. And, you know, as I said, I would really like to try to figure out some kind of situation that would work successfully for him and for all of us.
And Nikki...
But I imagine I will always have to be involved in and would like to be involved in Nikki's life.
Yeah. Nikki, do you feel that urgency, that it's important for you to be more independent?
No. I feel, of course I feel the urgency to know how. As long as I know how, and it doesn't look to the world like I'm living at home because I'm incapable, because I'm scared or more scared than the average person, then I would like to live alone. I mean, to live at home as long as possible.
As you can see, this is a point that our family is a little bit.
I know. But I have given this a lot of thought, and I've listened.
So have I.
I've listened to everything that's being said here and more over these years. And taking that all in, I feel like this makes sense. I just don't know how to get it across to others. And
but maybe you need to prove it. Maybe you need to prove that you can live on your own.
Prove that I can, as soon as I prove that I can, as long as my parents are still home, and that it's still okay, I would like to. But I am also willing to change my mind. Know how, so that when the moment happens, or if I change my mind, then I'm ready. That's how I feel about it and a lot of other things in life, like a job and school and other things that I should be doing, but I'm not.
We need to figure this out. Off the air, maybe.
Lizzie Gottlieb made the film Today's Man about her brother, Nikki. Steve Paulson spoke with him. You can come to our website, ttbook.org, and we'll link you to a website where you can learn more about Today's Man. You may know more than you think about our next guest. His name is John Elder Robison, and like Nikki Gottlieb, he has Asperger's syndrome. He also has a little brother, famous in the world of popular entertainment as Augustine Burroughs, the author of the best-selling memoir called Running with Scissors. Now, John Elder Robison has written his own memoir called Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's. He sat down with Anne Strangechamps and talked about his kind of autism.
Autism is really a continuum. You know, like the left end of the range, let's say you have the totally impaired people who can't live without assistance, and they maybe don't even speak at all. And then maybe you move to the center of the range, and you have people like me with Asperger's that are eccentric but articulate and get by on their own. But the continuum doesn't stop with me. It kind of fades further over into normalcy. Mm. So if you consider all the people who have some Aspergian traits, but maybe a psychiatrist wouldn't say they had Asperger's or autism, still, that probably doubles the number of people who are touched by it. And all of those people are those who will read my stories and say, you know, I saw myself in that and that and that. So maybe that's what, maybe at one out of every 50 or 60 people in the population.
You have a very successful life right now. I mean, you have for quite a while. If I hadn't read your book, would I even know you had Asperger's?
Well, you probably wouldn't know what I had. You would just know that I was a little eccentric. If you and I went out to a dinner, you might sit there thinking, you know, is he really interested in me? He's so serious. And indeed, I might not be serious at all, but I look this way and you can't tell. But if you came to my car business for the purpose of some kind of transaction with your car, you'd be coming seeking out my expertise, and as long as you received that, you'd probably be pretty satisfied. So in that regard, sure, I pass for normal in society. But when you move out of, say, workplace dealings and you move into social settings, people are more likely to think that you're strange. Even then, though, when you get to be my age, if you become fairly well-to-do and successful, that is a large part of making the transition from being weird to eccentric, and you become acceptable anyway.
A certain amount of weirdness is permissible if you've made enough money.
You know, that is just about the unfortunate truth of it in this country. You know, if you're eccentric and weird and you talk to people at a party in a little apartment, you're just another weirdo that everyone ignores. But if the party's in your own $2 million home, well, then you're just a successful eccentric.
Now, you grew up at a time when there wasn't even a diagnosis for Asperger's, and you weren't diagnosed yourself until fairly later in your life, right?
I wasn't diagnosed until I was 40 years old, and it was just a chance occurrence. I had started my automobile business, and this therapist who worked with troubled kids had bought a Land Rover from me. And one day, he came in and he said, you know, therapists make a practice to not diagnose their friends or they won't have any friends. But he said, in this case, I've got this book that I think describes you to a T, and I think that you really ought to read it. And the book was titled Asperger's Syndrome. And I learned that it was not just me that was a freak or a loser, but that I'm normal for what I am, and there are so many of us, they had a name for it. Because before he gave me the book, I'd never even heard of Asperger's.
So was it a relief to have a diagnosis?
Well, it was truly a life-changing experience because all of a sudden I was able to look at these things, and even such a simple thing as the title of my book, Look Me in the Eye, people would say all my life, they'd say, look me in the eye, young man. Look at me when I'm talking to you. And, you know, and I thought I was doing that. Clearly, I did not understand even the most basic social errors that I had been making all my life in my dealings with non-Aspergian people. So it was a huge, huge change for me for the better.
For the better, partly in the sense that for once you could stop feeling like there was something wrong with you?
Well, yes. For the first time in my life, I began to realize that I was not, you know, just a total fraud and a misfit, which is all people ever told me I was all my life. I always thought, well, if I could visualize, you know, a special effects system, if I could visualize something that would take a guitar and make it sound like something else, and I could imagine it in my mind, and then if I built it, if it sounded like I imagined, I thought, well, that's pretty good, you know, and it allowed me to function because I could make what musicians wanted. But I always felt, from an engineering standpoint, I must be a fraud because I didn't understand the engineering text. I could not write the equations that described what was happening to the waves going through it because I didn't know conventional mathematics like they taught it in school. And yet I could visualize these complex calculus functions in my mind as they were implemented in my circuits.
So what about in your family? I mean, your family's already sort of famous because your younger brother wrote a best-selling memoir about growing up in your family, and you'd left home by the time a lot of the things he wrote about happened. What was growing up in your family like before you left?
Well, one difference between the story that readers are going to encounter in my book and the story of childhood life and Running with Scissors is that when I was little, my parents, you know, were young, and I think they were hopeful, and they had dreams, you know, and they were pretty sort of together still. And when I was little, we had good times together. You know, we went out and we camped and we, you know, did stuff outdoors and I saw things. But my parents weren't happy together, and my father drank more and more, and as he drank, he got mean. And my mother developed a worsening mental illness that eventually led her to be institutionalized when I was a teenager. And all of that began to happen at about the time my brother was born. So for me, life as a small child has good memories and bad ones. For my brother, there weren't very many good times left. And his account is consequently kind of darker because it was a dark time. Then, when I was 16 and my brother was 8, I couldn't really take it anymore, and I left home. I had flunked out of school, and I was going nowhere, and I joined a band where I was accepted, and I was on my own. And all of the really crazy events that happened in Running with Scissors actually occurred when I was on the road with Kiss. And my brother, you know, sort of alludes to that in his chapter about me. But luckily for me, I guess I had escaped before the worst of that happened. And I actually didn't even know about it. I didn't know the extent of how bad it was until I read my brother's book. And I was just totally shocked because, you know, people reading Running with Scissors, you know, they remember this scene with Bookman having sex with my brother. And, you know, he tried to do the same thing to me 5 years before. And I was just totally shocked to read it. So I think that our books really complement each other because they provide sort of a continuity of our lives.
There's some funny moments. One of the funniest that made me laugh out loud is the moment when you're seeing this psychiatrist, Dr. Finch, and he tells you it's okay to rename your parents.
Oh, yes. And I named my father Stupid, and I named my mother Slave. And of course, you know, people who like my brother are going to be interested to know that he's also had some more names too. You know, when his book came out, he was called Augustine Burroughs, but people learned that he was born Chris Robison and changed his name. However, with the publication of my book, they're going to learn that that wasn't the first time, because when his mother brought him home from the hospital, I looked at him, and he kind of sat there, and my mother said, "This is your new brother, Christopher Richter Robeson." And I looked at him, and he kind of went at me, and I said, "Your name is Snort." And his name continued to be Snort until he was about 4 years old and he started taking my toys, at which point I told him his new name was Varmint.
So tell me about your years with KISS. I mean, you've had, as you say, more than one kind of remarkable career. Here you are growing up, this kid in high school with this sort of savant-like ability to intuit the way electronics work. How'd you wind up working for a huge rock band?
Well, I started with small bands, and I went to bigger and bigger bands, and I was working for Pink Floyd's Sound Company in New York City. They had this huge radio studio where I would fix and modify equipment, and one day they rented it to KISS to rehearse, and I was looking at them out there, and I saw Ace struggling with this guitar, and I went over and asked him what he was doing, and he said that he wanted to embed smoke bombs in the body of a Les Paul guitar so that it would blow fire on stage. And I said, "Well, I can do that." So he turns to his roadie and he says, "Tex, have Gibson ship this guy some Les Pauls." And, and they shipped me some Les Pauls, and I made him his smoking guitars, and that was how I came to do it. And after we did that, we made sort of a long line of guitars that, you know, did bizarre stuff, and it became really a centerpiece of Ace's act.
John Elder Robeson's book is called Look Me in the Eye. He spoke with N. Strange James. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Howard Dully's mother died when he was little. His father remarried, and the stepmother seemed to focus all her dissatisfaction on Howard. The mischief he got up to seems pretty normal today. But Lou, the stepmother, wouldn't rest until she found Dr. Walter Freeman, the champion of the transorbital lobotomy. He performed his ice pick lobotomy on Howard in 1960 when he was only 12. Howard says it more or less destroyed his life. Since he still couldn't please his stepmother, Howard grew to adulthood confined in mental hospitals. He also spent time in prison as he struggled for decades with alcoholism. Finally, in his 50s, Howard Dully set out to understand what had happened to him. He hooked up with David Isay, who helped him tell his story in a brilliant 1995 documentary for National Public Radio. Now, Howard has written a book with the same title. It's called My Lobotomy.
When we did the documentary for My Lobotomy, we went to the archives, Freeman's archives, and we got my file. And I got to read a lot of the indictment that they called it and a lot of the information that was transcribed.
It must have been amazing for you to see that file after all these years. What did it feel like when you saw that file?
God, I had a gamut of feelings. First, I guess I felt the weight lift off my shoulders because it verified that I wasn't the evil person that one would think I was. And I cried. I broke down. I was very sad that there was just a lot of lies in the file, and I couldn't believe that they were there when it would have been so easy to check them and verify.
My file has everything. A photo of me with the ice picks in my eyes, medical bills, but all I care about are the notes.
Mrs. Dully called up to say that Howard has been unbelievably defiant with a savage look on his face. He turns the room's lights on when there's broad sunlight outside and strange. He hates to wash. Okay. October 26, 1960. Howard is rather evasive about talking about things that go on in the home. November 30th, my birthday. Mrs. Dully came in for a talk about Howard. Things have gotten much worse, and she can barely endure it. December 17th, 1960. $200 for surgery, so the whole thing was $200. Well, that's pretty cheap. And I was supposed to fight all this, huh? No way. 12-year-olds couldn't stand against all that. Just wasn't fair.
Did you have trouble in school or trouble with other kids or anything?
I had trouble in school. I got in trouble with other kids. If I did something wrong, I usually had a pal with me to help me out so we'd share the blame.
Yeah. And you said you could hardly ever do anything wrong without getting caught.
Yeah, some reason I wasn't good at doing bad things. I'd always get caught. I'd leave a banana peel behind, or they'd always find out, and I might as well just put my name on it and said I did it, you know.
But looking in the file, you look at that stuff and you say, why did that justify this medical procedure? They stuck an ice pick in and did a lobotomy, and you were 12 years old.
Yeah, in both eyes. It took about 10 minutes was all it took, and I was told I was going in for tests.
How did you change?
Well, I seem to have lost a lot of my drive, a lot of my ambition. It's hard to say exactly how you changed. You become more introverted, less outgoing. Hard to believe in some cases. Some people think I'm very outgoing.
Do you feel like you're a different person because of it?
Yeah, mentally you will. You lose your self-esteem, you know, because you get the Frankenstein syndrome, the idea someone scrambled your brain and you're not normal, so to speak, and therefore you're different.
So did you tell people after that you'd had it?
No, I did not. We never discussed it. We didn't discuss it at home. It was never a topic of anything in a conversation. My brother was even sent away while I was at the hospital having it done, so when I came home, it wouldn't shock him.
When you meet people now, can they tell that you've had this lobotomy?
No. Nobody knew at all until I brought it up. No one's ever known.
Now, you've been through all of this. You've interviewed people. You've looked into your own history. Do you see things going on today that seem to you to remind you of this craze for the lobotomy that went on all these years ago?
Yeah, but it's different today. Today they're using more chemicals, pills and things. I'm concerned that they're overdoing it, but the nice thing I think about pills is they can be stopped. Whereas the lobotomy, once you did it, it was done. But, you know, I think we rush for a panacea, so to speak, to give someone to make everything better and so easy. It concerns me that we're on a slippery slope, so to speak, when we do that.
You've made some real strides in the last few years to get more control of your life. You've been able to do things, but you can't go back and undo what was done to you.
Correct.
You must be angry about that sometimes. In the portrait, in the Sound Portrait documentary, you actually confronted your father about it, and he wouldn't even talk about it, really.
Yeah. It's not, I had to get over the anger before I could even do the project. That was the difficult part, because being angry wouldn't have solved anything for me, and it would have done nothing but caused animosity. My father wouldn't have talked to me if we did it on a I'm-going-to-nail-you-to-the-wall type of interview. It had to be in a situation where, you know, this is just for information and things like that. So, you know, not to judge him as whether he was a good father or not.
Yeah.
Wasn't my purpose then.
Okay, so we're here to talk about my transorbital lobotomy. So how did you find Dr. Freeman?
I didn't. She did. She took you.
My question would be naturally, why would you let it happen to me if that was the case?
I got manipulated, pure and simple. I was sold a bill of goods.
So why do you think it's been so hard for us to talk about this in your estimation?
Largely because you never asked about it. It was an unpleasant part of my life, and I don't particularly want to delve into it.
It's Although he refuses to take any responsibility... Just sitting here with my dad and getting to ask him questions about my lobotomy is the happiest moment of my life.
Well, I want to thank you for doing this with me. I really do. I never thought that this would ever happen.
Well, you see, miracles occur.
Actually, what I wanted to do was tell you that I love you very
much. Well, whatever made you think I didn't know that?
You asked him if he was sorry about it.
Yes.
And you forgave him for doing this. Did that finish it for you? Is it over as far as you're concerned between the two of you?
Well, it has to be now. My father passed on a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
So it's kind of over there. But, you know, having a procedure like this, it's never really over. You have to live with it as long as you live.
Yeah. Did you ever get to talk to him any more about it?
Oh, several times we discussed it. He would jokingly say that we gave him a copy of the book, naturally. My new stepmom, read it twice. And my dad said that he read a little bit of it and was going to finish it someday, you know. But somehow I can't imagine that he didn't go from page to page through it. I mean, yeah. I know I would.
Yeah. And Lou, the stepmom who worked with Dr. Freeman to have this happen, she's gone now, too.
Yeah, she passed away in 2000, January 1st, as a matter of fact.
What's your life like now?
I'm back to training school bus drivers and in between interviews and book signings and things like that. I'm doing pretty good. I'm, you know, content with it. I knew that someday if I was capable of doing something like this, it's what I wanted to do.
Do you ever see your brothers? Or?
I've seen all my brothers except one. We don't really talk about it, but, you know, it's a little more open than it was.
It has to have been hard in some ways on them, too. I mean, they weren't told about it. This was not something anybody ever talked about much.
Yeah, and especially some of them felt that it was partly their fault that this had happened, and they didn't realize that there really wasn't anything they could do.
You don't blame them?
No, not at all.
But
not at all.
Do you still blame your stepmom?
Well, as much as I blame myself and my father, yeah. Am I brooding over it? No.
You said you don't blame your brothers any more than you blame yourself. Why do you blame yourself for this?
Well, because I charged headlong into it and helped instigate. I wasn't an angel in the whole thing.
You mean your behavior as a boy was rowdy?
Rowdy, and I knew how to push my stepmom's buttons, you know.
You knew how to make her angry.
Oh, yeah. Like any other kid could with their parents, believe me.
You must have, I suppose, in some ways been able to push those buttons pretty good.
Apparently. I just didn't know this would have been the result.
Did you ever think that it might be a good idea to just forget about all this, not talk about it?
Yeah, I did for many years, until I was in my 50s, and then I decided that, you know what, enough is enough. I have to get it out. If it's going to affect me inside for this many years, I have to do something.
Well, telling this story has to be an inspiration for some people who had the same fear of getting it out that you did. That must make you feel pretty good.
Yeah, I've received a lot of letters from people that have had experiences, not necessarily like mine, because not a lot of people have had lobotomies are still around, but other issues in the family, and to be able to share with them that you can live through it and still come out okay is a good feeling.
Howard Dully is the author of a memoir called My Lobotomy. Our thanks to David Isay for the excerpts from his documentary of the same name. If you'd like to hear all of that program, come to our website, ttbook.org, and we'll link you to the Sound Portraits website. How do you feel about our efforts to treat mental illness, especially in dysfunctional families? Are we too quick to medicate people? Let us know what you think at our website, It's ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. They don't award a Nobel Prize for compassion, but in the case of Oliver Sacks, maybe they should. For over 30 years, in books like Awakenings, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Seeing Voices, and An Anthropologist on Mars, Oliver Sacks has found ways to touch the lives of people with disorders, from Parkinson's disease to autism. And then he's told their stories in ways that touch our lives, too. He's done it again in his latest book called Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain. Sacks told Steve Paulson about one of the patients in his new book.
Tony was a surgeon in his early 40s, very robust and athletic and extroverted, with very little interest in music. And one day, this was in 1993, he was on the phone, it was an outside phone, a storm approached, a bolt of lightning flew out from the phone, hit him in the face, gave him a cardiac arrest, and along with this, an out-of-body experience. He was resuscitated, and he seemed pretty much himself, except 2 or 3 weeks later, he got what he called a sudden, insatiable passion to hear piano music, and then to play piano music, and then to compose music. And in the course of about 48 hours, he really became transformed. He became possessed by music. That was his term. He started getting up at 3 in the morning and he got a piano. He got a piano teacher. He learned to transcribe. He was at music when he came back from his surgery. He said his wife wasn't best pleased. And basically this has continued.
And there was nothing in his background that would suggest this love of piano music.
Really, very little, either on the musical side or, for that matter, on what he likes to call the spiritual side, because he now feels that this was a providential event, a sort of a divine intervention, and that, in a sense, the music comes from heaven and he has a mission to bring it to earth. And so there was also a certain change in character and a sort of a mystical element crept in.
And is he still a practicing doctor?
Yes, I was relieved to hear. He's a very, very good doctor, and he's still a practicing orthopedist and very well regarded. He asked me if I'd ever heard of anything similar, and I said, in some ways, I do know situations in which people have developed a sudden passion for music, but this usually goes with some, you know, very obvious change in the brain, and sometimes a stroke or a sort of dementia. And with him, you know, there simply seems to be the addition of this passion for music and this mystical element. I said to him, what do you think? And he said, as a medical man, he thinks it must be purely spiritual. And we left it there, although subsequently I saw him and I said, well, do you think maybe divine intervention might operate via the nervous system? Wouldn't God make use of the organism as it is? And he says, well, yes. And so, in fact, he's going to allow some tests.
You write about other cases where music is profoundly therapeutic. For instance, you have worked with people with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases. And these people may not be able to talk easily. They may not even be able to move very well. But often those problems seem to disappear when they listen to music or play music.
Yeah, well, this is where things started for me as a physician, and more than 40 years ago when I saw the patients whom I later described in Awakenings, and these people were almost transfixed with extremely severe Parkinsonism, catatonia, these sleepy sickness people, but music could liberate them in the most remarkable way, and they could dance, they could sing, they could move normally, they could think normally while the music lasted. Music can just have an amazing effect in recalling deeply demented people to life, and music has its special uses in aphasia and people who've lost language, because even though they may not be able to speak, they're usually able to sing, and often to recover the lyrics of a song.
Well, that's fascinating. So you're suggesting then that the part of our brain that deals with language is a different part than deals with singing, for instance.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This was really discovered, you know, right back in the 1860s when it was found that aphasic children could sing. And even though there might be damage in the left hemisphere of the brain causing the loss of language, singing seemed to be associated with the right hemisphere of the brain, although in general there's no music center in the brain. There's 20 or 30 different systems or networks in the brain involved in listening to music or imagining music or reacting to music. And I think this is why music is so robust. And even when speech may be lost, you know, other parts of the brain are still there.
Well, you say something astonishing in your book, that neuroscientists can actually spot a professional musician just by looking at the image of their brain.
Oh, yeah, I was very fascinated by this, and I wouldn't have believed it had I not sort of seen this myself. This is beautiful work, especially done by a man called Gottfried Schlaug up in Boston. He started some studies in the 90s using MRI imagery of the brain and very careful measurement of gray matter and white matter, different parts of the brain, comparing the brains of professional musicians and non-musicians. And he found that in many different areas, in the corpus callosum, this great bridge between the two hemispheres, in the auditory parts of the brain and in the motor parts of the brain and in the visuospatial parts of the brain, there was a real enlargement of gray matter in musicians' brains. And this is sometimes visible to the naked eye, so that although you can't look at a brain and say that's the brain of a mathematician or a visual artist, you can look at a brain and say this is probably the brain of a musician. And I think nothing shows the power of music and the response of the brain more clearly than that.
So do you think this different brain anatomy is something that is changed as people hone their talent for music, or is it something that some people are just born with?
I'm sure both. And sometimes it's difficult to tease out, because people who are naturally very gifted are likely to have, you know, intensive early musical training. But there have been studies with people who've had, say, a year of intensive violin training, the Suzuki method, looking at their brains before and after a year. And you can see very clearly the changes which have occurred.
You write about another remarkable case study, the English musician Clive Wearing. Explain what happened to him.
Clive was a very gifted musician and musicologist, pioneer in Renaissance music, when in 1985 he had a devastating brain infection, a herpes encephalitis, which especially destroyed some of the memory systems in his brain. So he developed a profound amnesia, so much so that he would lose everything in a few seconds. I mean, a film was recently made called The Man with a 7-Second Memory. If you came in the room, he would greet you. 10 seconds later, you'd be a stranger, and he'd greet you again. And along with this, there was a loss of many memories from his past life. A great deal of his autobiography was gone. So he had lost, you know, what neurologists call event memory or episodic memory. He'd lost much of his knowledge of the world, but his ability to perform music and even to conduct a choir or an orchestra at a masterly level was absolutely unchanged.
So he could remember those musical pieces. Somehow those memories came back to him, the musical memories.
Well, let's put it this way. The power of musical performance, the music came back to him. He might, you know, if you showed him a Bach fugue, you know, the printed page, he said, never seen it before. But if you just start him on the first note, he would play the whole fugue perfectly, and then in some amazement discover that he knew it, so that he possessed a huge memory of which he was unaware, which is sometimes called implicit memory. And when he was performing music, improvising at the organ, singing, conducting, he seemed utterly himself and, you know, gifted, charming, full of sensitivity and intelligence. Seconds later, he'd have no memory of this, and he'd be confused and disoriented and frightened. And so that there was this day and night difference between the two Clives.
Well, it also sounds like musical memory, or what you would call implicit memory, is different than other kinds of memory.
Yes, absolutely. And I think once music has been learned and rehearsed, it then becomes lodged to a large extent in more primitive parts of the brain. Perhaps one shouldn't say primitive, deeper parts of the brain, like the basal ganglia, the cerebellum. These are parts of the brain which are not damaged in amnesia. They're not damaged by strokes or dementia. And so really, if one has acquired a great skill, musical or otherwise, this will survive amnesia and it will survive dementia. One does see this in some other ways. I recently saw a remarkable actor who is amnesic, but his consummate acting skills and his huge Shakespearean repertoire are all there intact.
Does music still seem mysterious to you? I mean, you've obviously been looking at this and thinking about its effect on the brain for decades.
Yeah. The more I know about it, the more it puzzles me, the more mysterious it gets and the more wonderful. And then, you know, one puts on, or you suddenly hear from whatever the, you know, the slow movement of a Mozart violin, piano concerto or whatever, and it tears your heart out and you are excruciated and you're filled with feelings of joy and sometimes agony, and I think feelings which have no equivalent in the rest of life. And it is amazing. And I think it is deeply, deeply puzzling. We're beginning to sort of get somewhere with at least looking, seeing how the brain changes when people listen to music. But we're only at the beginning of understanding, and whether we will ever understand music, or for that matter, ever understand anything completely, I don't know.
Oliver Sacks has written several collections of case studies examining oddities of the human brain. The latest is Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain. Steve Paulson talked with Dr. Sacks. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 224A, Singular Brains. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Mike Ewing, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.